Okay. So the talk's titled, The Road to Heaven is Paved with Good Intentions. And really that our intentions, not a solid, singular, independent self, is what creates our happiness. If we could will up our happiness as some act of will, nobody would come to a Buddhist meditation class or retreat or this or that. It would just be possible, you know, for this ourself to order up happiness. But that's not how it works. What really determines our happiness is the sum of our actions, our choices, mental, physical, and with speech. Buddhism divides it traditionally into these three. So our intentional actions are super, super important. So important that the Buddha made it the second pillar of the Eightfold Path. And so for anyone who hasn't been before, we're in the middle of a series on the Eightfold Path. It's been going on, I don't know, 5 or 6 meetings, and it'll just keep going till we're done, whenever that will be. So there's kind of a yin-yang to meditation practice. One side of practice is being super receptive. What you may have heard in insight meditation many times as an instruction is don't interfere. Just let your experience be exactly what it is. Just pay attention to how it is. Don't get involved. Pretend your thoughts are coming from the person next to you. You know, this is this whole idea. We might have a lot of compassion for each other. But the whole idea here is to not interfere. Let it be exactly as it is. And this is a profound, profound transformative move. It's the paradoxical theory of change. Nothing changes until we allow it. And when you get out of the way, your mind states take care of themselves. If you're in there, you know, shoveling the coal under the fire, the mind state is just going to, right? But when we just observe flame as flame, or fear as fear, then actually we get some kind of balance. There's a part of us that's bigger than our experience, and we can handle it. And we start to realize that, wow, I can really let my emotional states arise because my mindfulness is really going to take care of me. When I'm curious and interested and not swept away in the story, then my emotions become energy that just wants to move. And my emotions can start to take care of themselves. And then we feel what the Tibetans call the lion's roar, which is a kind of confidence that we can handle our lives because we can handle our emotions. So it's a very, very powerful practice of non-interference, acceptance, allowing, and being with. And over time, there's this magical process where mindfulness, just the simple act of paying attention, is a kind of purification. And from 2,500 years of people doing this practice, we know that the path is one of purifying. And just like Michelangelo chipped away everything that wasn't David, mindfulness chips away everything that isn't your inner Dalai Lama. What mindfulness does is actually transforms over time our tendencies towards suffering states, and it leaves behind compassion, love, contentment, equanimity, and, you know, many good states and joy. And mindfulness does that all by itself. So the big summary of all this, and this is an internal statement, changing nothing changes everything. Where actually this is one very powerful side of the practice, and it's one that we don't know how to do until we train in it. You know, we're so used to doing something with our experience to change it that we don't realize mindfulness allows the experience to change itself. So there's a whole nother side of practice. And the other side of practice is to be intentional, to have determination, to have will, to actually step in and say no. Not A, but B. You know, to actually really be strong, not just receptive, allowing, but to actually take action. And obviously, changing nothing changes everything is only an internal statement. You know, we need to be changing things in the world. And we need to be changing things in ourselves as well. It works both ways. And so the Eightfold Path only has three on this side of meditation and just allowing and observing. Only three of the folds of the eight are on meditation. So there's wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration. The other five are about our engagement, both internally and externally with the world. They're on this active side of the path. So the Dalai Lama is very clear on how important intentional action and even determined action is. And he writes, as human beings, we are gifted with this wonderful human intelligence. Besides that, all human beings have the capacity to be very determined and to direct that strong sense of determination in whatever direction they like. So long as we remember that we have this marvelous gift of human intelligence and a capacity to develop determination and use it in positive ways, we will preserve our underlying mental health. So this is in an article about countering stress and depression. So we don't want to only accept and allow and observe. We also want to take wise action and be determined, you know. So the second element of the Eightfold Path comes after the first. The first is wise view. And we've talked, okay, I said it a while ago, but just to put you on the spot, what are the three elements of wise view that we explored? Four Noble Truths is one. Karma, yeah.
No self,
exactly. So these are views that help us actually really guide the vehicle of our practice in the direction of more freedom. So it's the path starts with wise view. And then it's followed by wise intention. Out of wise view, when we understand, at least at a basic level, the Four Noble Truths, karma, and no separate independent self, we actually want to take great care with our actions because we understand that our actions is what is going to be creating our future happiness, not an act of will. Right? You can't just usually will up happiness. Usually it comes. And it comes, you know, from circumstances outside of you, but it also comes from past circumstances inside of you that are part of your karmic mind stream. Basically, most simply, it comes from our habits. So the more we practice loving kindness, say in metta practice, the easier loving kindness becomes. The more we practice anger, defensiveness, resentment, resistance, the easier that becomes. This is a very, very simple understanding of karma, but deep, very deep. People can ask, well, how much is good to practice? And I just like to say, you're always practicing. We're always practicing, and we know this from neuroscience, neuroplasticity. The mind is always reshaping itself. The mind greases its own skids. Whatever we do now is easier to do in the future. So when we understand that side of karma, we want to take care with our actions because we understand we're not going to will up how we're doing tomorrow. It's really going to be, I'm speaking very poetically, a result of what we did today. Today is tomorrow's yesterday. The the past has already happened. You can't control the karmic seeds you've already planted. Those will bear fruit somehow as mental habit. It's already done. There's not a thing you can do about it. But what you can do is create new habits today that will be tomorrow's past. And then that will be out of your control. You will unfold in love and happiness lawfully as a result of your past actions. So when we understand wise view and that it's really karma, parentheses, mental habits that control a lot of how we're doing, then we want to take care of ourselves now. And we want to be very clear about our intentional actions. So it's natural that wise intention flows from wise view. When we understand the Four Noble Truths in wise view, and that craving is the cause of suffering, then we want to actually abandon craving. And I'll say more about that. So that's another piece of one of our wise intentions, is to actually be intentional about abandoning craving, whatever that means. It doesn't just mean desire. We'll talk more. And when we understand no self, we get it. That, yeah, I can will up little things here and there, but I can't will up, oh, now I'm just going to be super content, you know. Or now I'm just going to be super mindful. We can't just decide that. We actually have to practice. Practice of meditation is basically developing a new habit. We can will up little moments of mindfulness. I can be with this half breath, and now this, that we can do. But we can't sit here and say, today I'm going to be mindful all day. Have you had that one work? Not miss a moment? That's the self thinking that we can just will it. We can't. Why? Because your habit is not that strong yet. So in Tibetan, the word gom means making yourself familiar with. Gom is the word for meditation. Basically, it means we're developing a new habit, making ourselves familiar with being mindful, with letting go of past and future, and just resting in the now. We've got to practice in order to get enough reps at the meditation gym. I know everyone's using the gym, brain gym, gym, meditation gym, I don't know. It's Boulder, I guess. But so we need a lot of reps, right, to build the muscle of your mindfulness. And then it comes out of your control. You start being a lot more mindful, just as grace, the grace of your past efforts. So when we really get not self, we get, yes, we need to again and again and again, moment by moment, put in the effort to be mindful. Because you're not going to just will it up and then you took your mindful pill and you're just done, you know? It takes practice. So, just random humor on not self. A woman coming to a zendo and introducing herself to the Zen master, saying, "Hi, I'm Marcy Peterson, even though there's no such thing as the self." So Marcy's not going to be able to just will it up, but she can sit there and, you know, again and again, come back to her breath and actually create this gong, this familiarity of mindfulness. So, if we want to take care of our future happiness, we need to take care of our karma / habits. And the way we need to do that is to bring much awareness to our intentions. It's not the actions themselves in Buddhist theory that create our karmic imprints. It's the intention or motivation that the action springs from. So a surgeon can cut someone open with a knife and have very wholesome karma. The intentions are to help and to heal. A thief can cut someone open with a knife. The action's the same, and yet they have completely different karmic imprints. It's all the motivation behind the action that is actually really determining our well-being over the long haul. So we need to understand what's motivating us, what's driving us, what are the intentions behind what we're doing. Does that make sense? Now, one thing to just clarify, I'll be using the word intention. It can be used interchangeably with motivation. But I can have a karmically neutral action, reaching. There's this intention to grab a glass and drink the water. That's not what determines your karma, these basic mechanical things like now I will open the door or now I will get out of bed. It's the mind state that intention is coming out of. So basically, in the Buddhist teachings, it's greed, aversion, and delusion are the three roots of our future unhappiness. And the opposite, non-greed, there's a more positive word for that, generosity, thank you. Generosity, love, and wisdom are the opposite of greed, aversion, and delusion. And remember, you can't really practice wisdom, but you can practice mindfulness, and wisdom develops from it. So basically, generosity, kindness, and wisdom, if our intentions can come from that, we are actually, that's the best we can do for ensuring our future happiness. And this is all Buddhist theory. But it's a theory that's been put into practice for 2,500 years, so it works. We know it works. So we want as much as possible, when we watch the intentions of generosity, kindness, and mindfulness flow by, we want to act on those. And then they become intentional actions. That's got the potential to change us, make us happier. When greed, aversion, and delusion float by, we don't need to quarrel, we don't need to get in a struggle, but we want to maybe just watch and really get aware and not act those. This is the simplest Buddhist formula for getting happier. Act on your wholesome impulses. Simply observe without judgment your unwholesome impulses. And wholesome and unwholesome are not judgmental words. They're really words about what works, what conditions your happiness, what conditions your misery, basically. So the Buddha, in talking about wise intention, listed three kinds. They sort of relate to generosity, kindness, and wisdom, a little different. The first is renunciation, and that is another thing that you could look at as the opposite of greed. So renunciation, if we direct the Four Noble Truths inwardly, we want to refrain from craving, because craving is the cause of suffering. Now, what craving doesn't mean is desire. What it means is the three reactions of greed, aversion, and delusion to the feeling tones of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. The pleasant, we just want it. The unpleasant, we don't want it. The neutral, we ignore. So that's craving. So renunciation fits with the opposite of greed, aversion, and delusion. We want to practice generosity or non-greed. We want to practice non-aversion or kindness. And we want to practice non-delusion or wisdom. So these are the three things we want to incline towards, our intentions. And so the second, this gets a little, don't be too confused by this, but The second intention that the Buddha talked about is non-ill will, or kindness. And that's basically the Four Noble Truths applied outside of yourself. It's craving, applying the truth of craving outside yourself. It's the opposite of aversion, kindness towards others. And then the third intention, he said, so renunciation, kindness, and harmlessness, intentions to not harm. These are very important because, again, our harmful karmic actions cause harm not just for others but bounce back at ourselves and cause harm for us in our future. So when we really understand wise view and karma, we want to practice renunciation, we want to practice kindness, and we want to practice non-harming. Make sense? Any confusion? Okay, so we've talked, you know, many times in class around ethical behavior, so I'm not going to focus on that too much. We've talked a lot about metta in this class, so I'm not going to focus on that too much. I'm going to focus on renunciation. But let me just quickly, what are the five lay precepts, the five basic precepts that the Buddha prescribed to lay people to avoid harm? Okay, avoiding killing. Yes, avoiding harmful speech. Not taking what's not given or not stealing.
Not using substances to the point of heedlessness.
Not harming yourself or others through substances, drugs and alcohol. Right, not harming through sexuality, right? So those are the five lay precepts, and those are just five very simple guidelines. Imagine what a different world this would be if people followed those five. No harming with speech, are you kidding me? No harming with sexuality, no harming yourself or others with intoxicants, no killing, no lying, or harming with speech. That's huge. These are huge, huge practices. So, you know, there you go. There's five little spurs to your practice to practice in life. Why? Not just to benefit others, to benefit yourself. This conditions your future happiness. Okay. So renunciation. What really the rest of the talk is going to focus on. So if you would, close your eyes. Just we'll do a brief little experiential, very brief. And just follow your breath. And now if you would, let your attention do what we did before. Energetically drop down into the heart and become aware of thoughts and images which might be occurring in the mind. And then notice what thought or image just pops to your head when I say the word renunciation. Just notice. Okay, and we're done with that. So, just popcorn style, what popped up? What was your first reaction to the word renunciation?
An image of an ascetic, you
know. An image of an ascetic. And is that neutral, good, or bad in your mind?
Yeah, kind of on the harsh side.
Okay. So kind of a harshness, harsh ascetic.
Pretty extreme version of the ascetic.
Okay. What else?
I just saw like I want to use the word wall, but it wasn't. It was, but something that just came up in my.
Like a wall, like a big no, like.
Well, it was
stop.
Just this white, almost like wet cement or something. moved away very rapidly.
And is there any meaning to that for you?
No, but it didn't feel good.
Okay. No meaning, but didn't feel good.
I was
good.
Actually feeling kind of disappointed that I didn't, you know, because this wasn't like a wall, like with a top and a bottom. It was just like a hole.
Okay.
Like this big blob that moved away.
Okay.
I had an association that was general and diffuse, but it had something to do with Catholicism.
Catholicism.
And I don't know why.
And is Catholicism shaded negative, positive, neutral?
I don't want to offend anyone in the group.
It's just for you.
It was negative.
Yeah, okay. So this is just your personal. All it is, this is what popped up in your mind when you heard this word. So this isn't about saying what's right or wrong. It's just this is your experience. Uh-huh.
Okay, this is someone kneeling down.
Someone kneeling down?
Something that was really undesirable for
okay.
that person.
Okay. And one last.
I have an image of the sky. Uh-huh. That actually felt like very positive and neutral.
Uh-huh. So an image of the sky and positive and peaceful. Okay, so harsh aesthetic, a wall that didn't necessarily, we weren't quite sure what that meant, a negative association with Catholicism, kind of giving up something that was maybe like hard on the person, and one positive big sky. Well, yeah. So this is not a favorite topic for us lay people. Renunciation is just like, oh, really? You know, if I had wanted to renounce, I would have been a monk or a nun, like, I'm in these lay clothes, you know, so, you know, as the saying goes, I'm not here for a long time, I'm here for a good time. Come on. Party on, Wayne, you know? Party on, Garth. Yeah, and guess what? You know, we're in this tradition is Theravada Buddhism. When I was a novice monk for 3 months in Thailand, I was teased by the Thais for being such a fat man. The robe goes like this, so you show this collarbone, and the more collarbone you're showing, the better monk you are. You know, oh, not too much collarbone there. And one guy, literally, he would squeeze my arms. Oh, very fat man, very fat man. This is a lay person in the monastery. We were good buddies. This is a really old guy. He would always stop. So fat, so fat. So.
They don't come to Texas.
Yeah.
You know, so this is seen as this is revered in monastic cultures. Lots of collarbone, not much eating, lots of renunciation. It's got a very different association in Buddhist countries. In the West, we really don't like this one very much. So, when I was at Wat Pa Nanachat, I was actually what's called an Anagarika, which is like a pre-novice monk. I was only on 8 precepts, but, you know, these were big ones, you know. Abstinence, can't hold money, can't sleep on a high and luxurious bed, so we got a little straw mat on a wooden floor. And we slept 6 hours a night. Every seventh night, we tried to stay up all night meditating and just doing the Theravada nod. And we ate once a day. And the whole idea was to provoke your discomfort. And it was hard, but man, was it also joyful. I mean, when you don't have to cook and you're just supposed to take whatever's put in your bowl, food is like, yeah, okay, time to eat, guess I'll eat. And it's just, you might think of it, especially in Boulder, right, the foodiest small town, wow, what a bummer, you know? But, you know, it just became food. It was just food. So we had to set aside a lot of sensual pleasure, but what we got in the place of it was time to meditate a lot and deep community of people really, really interested in liberation and freedom. So there was a lot of renunciation, but it was deeply joyful because it was in service of, for me, what mattered most. It was in service of my liberation. And my label for Wapat Nanichat was Fort Liberation. It felt like boot camp. It felt like the army in a way, ironically, because it was hard. And yet, I was so happy. So renunciation can be seen as a very negative thing, but it isn't. Renunciation very simply means just giving up what's really going to get in the way of your true happiness. And in that monastic context, it was people signing up for, wow, I want to intensely challenge my attachment to sensory pleasure. Because I know as good as sensory pleasure is when we have it, it's also fleeting. It's not a very reliable base for my happiness. If I'm basing my happiness on pleasant experience, then when that pleasant chicken flies the coop, you know, I'm unhappy. And the pleasant chicken does that all day long, you know, and leaves behind the poop and the droppings, you know. But that's a part of life too. It's just as much there as the chicken. And then the neutral is just as much there. So Buddhism is all about finding a happiness that doesn't depend on pleasantness. I mean, that's like foundation, so key. And so renunciation is actually really about using this incredibly precious gift. If you reflect on the fact that, boom, you were just born. You didn't ask for it. You didn't will it. This gift of life was given to you. Whammo, you're here. How amazing. And we have this incredible gift. And what do we want to use it for? Renunciation is giving up everything that's going to get in the way of you using your gift to your utmost. You're giving up only that is what's getting in the way of the true, real you. Now, that's easy to say, but hard to do. Hard to even know what that is, right? What is the real us? What do I really want? Whatever it is you really want, renunciation just means go for it and don't distract yourself, you know, with the miles of aisles of, you know, lemon zest, extreme tortilla chip, avocado, you know, chipotle bliss, you know, that's in a bag, and like that's going to do it for you, right? Not. Don't distract yourself. And of course you will, and of course I do all the time. I distract myself plenty. But renunciation is really about remembering what really matters and going for it. So it's not giving something up. It's actually prioritizing what matters. So the poet Naomi Shihab Nye, Palestinian American, writes, it's in the poem The Art of Disappearing, when they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You'll never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. So, it's just about prioritizing. It's not about harshness. It's about love. It's about care. It's about either knowing what really matters and acting from it, or deciding that, you know what, actually, I really need to work on that and explore that a little more. What is it that really matters? That's what renunciation is. It's exploring that and then committing to it. as lay people, we want to have it all. And there's kind of a myth that we can have it all. And so just a little humor about that. Here's a cartoon. There's a little boy, maybe six, with a yarmulke in Santa's lap. And he's saying, first of all, the little boy is saying, first of all, this conversation never happened. We want it all, right? We want Hanukkah and Christmas. And hey, if we're Jew-boos, you know, maybe we can have Hanukkah, Christmas, you know. Oh, but then the Buddhist thing, I don't know, that's not going to do so much. It's just, how well does it work to be constantly chasing? Sure, it works. And fleeting pleasure, you know, is great while it lasts, you know. So this is not to in any way disparage that. I mean, you know, dancing, parties, I mean, it's great. It's a way of really having joy. And as long as you feel that's supporting, you know, what's really deep for you, great. But if it's not, then, hey, maybe do a little less of it. And then there's the kind of tricky renunciation, which sometimes you hear, you know. Actually, renunciation really means not giving things up. It's giving up your attachment to things. So then you really do get the Hanukkah and the Christmas. And here's a cartoon about that. Two people talking in a big mansion with big art on the wall. And one is saying to the other, the beauty of it all is as long as the beauty of it all is that as long as I'm not attached to my things, I don't have to give any of them up. So, again, you know, we want to be free. We all probably have a very deep yearning for some way of feeling freer, more spacious, less reactive in our hearts. But we don't want to have to, you know, in any way be uncomfortable to go there. We don't want the middle path of Buddhism. We want the upper middle path. But actually, I think we all know that we're willing to face discomfort when it will help us get something we want. And actually, it can be fun, exciting, interesting even, to give things up when we know it's going to help us. You know, it's going to make us freer. I mean, why else would people do Outward Bound, you know? Yeah. Right? And now these, you know, boot camp things that people do a lot, right? You know, give me 20. What's the TV show? Oh, World's Biggest Loser, right? Give me 20. Right? I mean, there's this whole boot camp thing that people are doing to kind of, like, better themselves. We're really willing to actually dig deep and get uncomfortable when we know it matters. So renunciation can be really gritty and kind of strong, and for men, manly, and for women, womanly. You know, it can feel really good. It's not negative. It's not about hating yourself to deny the self to get closer to some, you know, God or some universal thing. I mean, often that's something we've gotten in our religious upbringing, is that we have to really deny the self in a really punishing sort of way to get closer to God or closer to whatever. And this is not the spirit of that at all. The spirit here is kindness as an act of love and care. Because I'm worth it, I'm going to not do X, Y, or Z. So Pema Chodron, she has kind of a nice way of thinking about renunciation and relating it to meditation. She writes, renunciation does not have to be regarded as negative. I was taught that it has to do with letting go of holding back. What one is renouncing is closing down and shutting off from life. You could say that renunciation is the same thing as opening to the teachings of the present moment. When we sit in meditation, we feel our breath as it goes out, and we have some sense of willingness just to be open to the present moment. Then our minds wander off into all kinds of stories and fabrications and manufactured realities, and we say to ourselves, "It's thinking." We say that with a lot of gentleness and a lot of precision. Every time we are willing to let the storyline go, and every time we are willing to let go at the end of the out-breath, that's fundamental renunciation. Learning how to let go of holding on, how to let go of holding back. So just engaging with life by letting go of all of our stories and instead engaging. So that's a real kind of renunciation. So the last thing I want to say, and Soknyi Rinpoche, Tibetan teacher, has a very simple teaching on renunciation. He just says, just let go of that which is getting in the way of you having a regular practice. And if you're doing that, you know, that's huge and big. So, you know, and this is my coming in now. This is my interpretation. So just be gentle and be kind. You know, if you can just give up little things, you know, throughout the day or week that'll help you sit more, then you're doing a lot for renunciation, you know. But do it in the spirit of care. You know, you're not going to let the dishes pile up in the sink for too long, probably. So you don't want to let the inner dishes pile up so much either, you know. Really see it. It's like self-care and self-love to give up a little bit to sit more. Okay, so that's my pep talk, and I'll stop there. I'll invite a little bit, maybe just one response, because we're just almost at time, and then we'll just sit for a minute or two. Yes?
Did you say that part of it comes naturally, as you said, and observe yourself, that naturally you feel like announcing?
Yes.
Too much food, so you want to wake up tomorrow morning and be fresh?
Yes. Yes, so the comment is that question, with practice, as you practice more, probably you're going to just want to, you know, give things up, and it's not going to feel so much like forcing. Yes, as we see more clearly through our practice, renunciation becomes easier, because we see that, right, that thing has this like illusion of doing something for me, but my awareness and attention shows me not so much. Maybe a little bit. So yes, definitely. A very famous Zen teacher, Suzuki Roshi, said renunciation is not so much giving things up, but about seeing that things change. And the more we understand that we have these experiences and we kind of stop, like, oh, when I do this, I'm going to be complete. But then we get there, and it's just time flowing through your hands like water, you know, and it's just fleeting and impermanent, not to bum anyone out, but it's like, it's just to get real. We had this illusion of getting complete by some little thing, and we got there, and it was just flowing. And when we see that things are really impermanent, we naturally renounce more. So that's the kind of thing that happens. Okay, so we'll just sit for a couple of minutes.